Scott had a sign in the words.
Okay, now we got it. Okay. Let's go back to Oklahoma.
What
was the chemistry department like for a young graduate student at the time? Any notable?
Very few notable personages in the chemistry department. I can recall one little anecdote that when I went looking for a project to work on, for a thesis, I discussed the possible opportunities with all the professors, and I managed to include in all of my interviews, and what kind of financial support do you have for this type of work? And one professor, I recall, accused me of prostituting science before I became one. And I had to agree with him. I said that all this is very interesting to me, and I would just as soon be interested in a subject that has some financial backing. Mm-hmm. And frankly, that is the way I picked the project I would work on, the area of chemistry. The area of chemistry I selected was some nitration studies or some diphenols and biphenols and things of this sort. And this work was sponsored by the, I guess it's Army Ordnance Business that was interested in nitrated compounds.
Were you nitrating bisphenol A at that time? Diphenols?
Diphenols, yes, but bisphenol A, no.
Uh-huh.
Bisphenol A was somewhat of a curio at that time.
Mm-hmm.
There really wasn't any around. Nobody was thinking about it, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
But I did a lot of nitration of phenols and chromatographically separated them and made derivatives and characterized them and all the classical things that one does.
Synthetic organic. Yeah.
Excuse my ignorance, but is this for explosives or what's the purpose of these?
Well, ultimately they could be explosives, but we were not nitrating far enough to make explosives. What we were trying to do was determine the course of reactions, which spot does the nitro group hit first and second, and if you change the solvents and change the conditions, can you change the isomer distribution and things of this sort.
So this was really in the heyday of physical organic chemistry with ortho-para ratios and kinetics of substitution reactions and all of that.
That's right. And what are catalyst effects on orientation and things of this sort.
All this stuff we teach the kids.
So you were trying to learn the mechanisms behind the reactions which the Army would later use to make explosives? Is that the idea? Or make what?
Well, I hate to put in the word explosives in here, but I guess most nitro compounds have some ultimate application in mm-hmm. explosives. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And that was literally the research I was doing, was trying to understand how to control the sites for nitration.
Mm-hmm. Who was your professor?
He was James C. Colbert. He was for Canfield. He was advisor to the students, undergraduate students who were going to med school.
Mm-hmm.
He had leanings toward biochemistry.
Now, was this the project where you had, or maybe I'm jumping ahead of the story, where you had that experience with the...
No.
Okay.
I managed to get through the regular graduate school. But a little incident happened about one semester away from getting my PhD or finishing that up. The Army Air Force called me up and said they could use me in, I guess it was Korea that was going on at that time. And they felt I had done such a good job as a navigator in the Pacific, flying from Saipan to Japan, that they could use me either as an instructor or navigating planes to Korea or something. And they wanted me in the Army immediately, or Air Force immediately. And I explained that I was a semester away from graduate school, or from PhD. Could I get out that long or stay away that long? And they said they would let me stay to finish.
Mm-hmm.
So I was looking at forward, and that was a great deal of pleasure to graduating and going back in the Air Force.
Mm-hmm.
And there just happened to be a prof who had a lot of unused funding from an atomic energy supported project, and he asked me if I would like to stay on as a postdoc student.
Mm-hmm.
And I assured him that I would really love to stay on as a postdoc student, provided he could talk to the Air Force. And he said he didn't think there would be any trouble, that the Air Force had more, or the Atomic Energy Commission had more influence than the Air Force, and he arranged it.
Mm-hmm.
He was a great man.
Who was that?
His name was Seymour Wender.
Oh, Wender, sure.
Cy Wender.
Sure, sure.
And, well, there's a couple Wenders, so.
Yeah.
I'm not sure you would notice. He was a product of Emory.
Mm-hmm.
And he had a pretty outstanding man working with him by his name of Ceresco, who was a biologist also, a biochemist. But it turned out that Dr. Wender, or Cy Wender, had a lot of Atomic Energy Commission funds, which he had been working on anti-radiation compounds.
Mm-hmm.
And specifically, they were following up somewhat late a lead of a Dr. St. Georgi, who is still alive working with
Oh, yeah.
St. Georgi had discovered much earlier what he called a vitamin P complex. And he had isolated this vitamin P type material from Hungarian red peppers. And being Hungarian, I guess it fits. And what this isolated material seemed to do was to strengthen blood vessels. And a classic example is people who bruise easily have a deficiency of vitamin P complex. And if you feed them, if he fed animals his vitamin P extract, it would strengthen their blood vessels. And what happens in the case of radiation damage to humans or to animals is that the blood vessels lose their flexibility and they rupture and you die from internal hemorrhage. And the concept at the time was if there was anything to St. George's thesis, then we ought to be able to isolate some plant pigments which we could feed to animals, which would strengthen the blood vessels and provide some immunization to radiation damage.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what the Atomic Energy Commission was supporting. So the school at Oklahoma, they have a research institute which has took over the postdocs type work. And they had a number of students who had been isolating all kinds of plant pigments. And we were sending those to the University of Michigan Med School that was evaluating them. And the way they evaluated them was to shave the tummies of rats or rabbits, is really what they were doing, feed them a diet of our extracts, and then you would put a suction cup on the bare tummy and pull a vacuum for a couple minutes and count the number of capillary ruptures or petechiae per square inch. And on an animal with no treatment, let's say there were 20, and if he had eaten a certain amount of somebody's test thing, it may drop down to 10, and that was in the right direction. And what you were looking for was something to drop it down to no ruptures. And this was the type of work that we were doing at Oklahoma in trying to isolate these things. And a number of students had arrived at the specimens that actually extracts of apricots and prunes seemed to be very efficient. And we were isolating these by combination of grinding them up and stewing them with cold water, ion exchange columns to get rid of the sugar, chromatographing them, and things of this sort. But most of them were coming out in the order of milligrams per kilograms or multi-kilograms of starting material. And the thing that we isolated or had been isolated looked best of all was a chemical called isoquercetrin, which is a flavonoid compound or flavonoid that contained a sucrose molecule on the side. And what my job after a short period of time of isolating was, can you synthesize this molecule from scratch? And if you can synthesize it, then we could have a larger supply. And also, if you could synthesize it, we would like to put in a radiocarbon so we could feed it to the animals and find out what happens to it,
mm-hmm.
where it operates from. And so that was my job, to try to do that. And I started the synthesis. And one of the fragments that I needed for the synthesis was guaiacol, which is ortho-methoxy-phenol. And there was no ortho-methoxy-phenol around, but I learned that we had unlimited supply of guaiacol carbonate, which happened to be a pharmaceutical supply from the Navy. And it is used in, what do you call them, humidifiers,
mm-hmm.
to generate a medicinal odor, which one breathes and supposedly provides some respiratory relief, some clogged up respiratory passages.
What is guaiacol carbonate?
It is the OH that's on there is hooked to another molecule.
It's organic.
The same thing.
It's an organic carbonate.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay.
It's
okay.
So
you got you.
It's diphenyl carbonate with a couple of methoxy groups on it.
Yeah. my goodness, can you make guaiacol carbonate without using phosgene? How do they make guaiacol carbonate?
The guaiacol comes from plant extracts.
It's a natural
product. Yeah. They get vanillin from and all sorts of things.
Mm-hmm.
And I think they use phosgene to make the carbonate.
Okay.
But in any event, I had unlimited supply of guaiacol carbonate, and I only needed 50 grams or 20 grams of guaiacol. So I assumed that the easy thing to do was to put a little bit of caustic in with this guaiacol carbonate and boil it for a few minutes, because everybody at the time knew that carbonates were very susceptible to hydrolysis. And you could put carbonate protecting group on something and do another reaction and take it back off pretty easily. So that was common knowledge. Carbonates are very easy to tear apart with a little aqueous caustic. So I put the guaiacol carbonate in with my aqueous caustic and proceeded to boil it, and it just steam distilled away from the caustic unchanged. So I put a reflux condenser on and left the reflux for a day.
Mm-hmm.
It was still coming off as guaiacol carbonate unhydrolyzed.
Mm-hmm.
So I gave up. And I had actually taken the thing I was boiling home and left on the kitchen stove so I could wash it overnight in case it happened. It smelled up the apartment a bit, but I couldn't tear it apart conveniently. I know I could have if I had used pressure and all sorts of things, but it was easier to order the stuff from Eastman Kodak and wait for a week and get it, which is what I did.
Just the methoxyl group blocking the
methoxyl
attack?
Later on I found out what it was called, but it was a steric hindrance effect.
Yeah.
So I tucked that one away in my memory and ordered Eastman Kodak and continued the synthesis, and got about two-thirds to maybe a little more than that through the thing. And my year of postdoctoral work was completed, and the Air Force had lost interest in me.
Mm-hmm.
So I left and went looking for a job.
Did anything come of this whole effort to the anti-radiation business, or did you ever follow
well,
that?
Well, I'll tell you. I think that we learned something from it, and there was some value from it, but they never really got around to seriously treating people with the thing. But actually, I can give you advice, medical advice. If you have a weak blood vessel system, it can be strengthened very considerably with these materials. And the simplest remedy you can take is to eat apricots. They're very rich in the particular compound. Prunes are also very good, but they have some other physiological effects. But they're in the same family. But the apricots were rich. Now, one experiment we had learned, I don't know whether they're practicing it or not, but you can also get a fair concentration of a homolog which has some effect, which is called rutin. And this comes from the outside covering of buckwheat grain. And it's pretty easy to come by, and you can buy it for several dollars a pound. Or grams or something, but it isn't very expensive. It's not quite as effective as the thing we had found, but they did actually report that they had fed dogs a lot of this rutin for a week or 2 weeks, and then irradiated them, and the dogs which had been dosed with the rutin came through about 90%, and the ones who didn't have it died about 90%.
Mm-hmm.
9 out of 10 died, 9 out of 10 lived. difference between treated with that or not. And there was stories, I can't confirm, that they were giving people dosage of rutin and other similar things prior to radiation treatment for cancer or whatever they have. But I think that the technology has gotten so far now that they do not have this kind of problems. Incidentally, one of the things that the humorous that came out of the study was, it turns out that the reason the blood vessels lose their flexibility is almost has a parallel in a rubber hose laying out in the sun. And the heart pumps and the thing expands and contracts, and when you lose the flexibility, when the heart pumps, you get varicose veins and things of this sort. And it is possible to do a pretty good maintenance job on the body by eating foods and fruits and stuff rich in this vitamin P factor. But it turns out that the loss of flexibility in the blood vessels is essentially an oxidation reaction.
Mm-hmm.
And
yeah,
the flavonoids that we are after are working are have everything that one would need in a plastic for an antioxidant. They have a ketone ring and a bunch of hydroxys around a aromatic, two aromatic rings fused together type thing.
Mm-hmm.
So now if I looked at a flavonoid, I would say it's probably an experimental antioxidant.
Yeah.
Whereas in the day, I don't know what an antioxidant was.
Yeah.
The other thing that's different is that these materials occur with or without sugars on them, and without the sugar, they pass right through the body without being digested. And with the wrong kind of sugar, they pass through the body without being digested. And the key thing that separates a lot of them is the ones that have a sucrose or glucose unit on it will be absorbed into the body, and the same compound without it has no effect. And the body has ability to hydrolyze these sugars in the stomach, so one of the reasons why they're not quite as effective as they might be is that maybe you do get an adequate amount, but the stomach acid tears off the sugar and you lose it. But as I said, it is an antioxidant effect. Radiation is an oxidation.
Yeah.
And they found that in two things that were quite capable of providing equivalent results. One is a little bit of bisulfite, and that has bad effects, but it will also protect from radiation. And they had some little bugs and things of this sort. They put a little bisulfite in and irradiate them, and they don't die. So they can experiment on humans with that. And the other one is alcohol is preferentially oxidized in the body. And this provides a perfect excuse to get drunk. And so all you need to do is assume there might be an air raid, a nuclear attack, so you drink. But unfortunately, when the alcohol gets oxidized, it turns into aldehydes. And they aren't very good for you, but essentially any antioxidant that is tolerable in the body can provide a reasonable degree of radiation protection. I think there are some interesting things that the body, when it gets old, it loses flexibility, it runs out of antioxidant, and you start leaking internally from internal hemorrhage. The heart keeps pumping and the blood vessels can't contract. But anyhow.
So anyway, you're back at finished at Oklahoma. You're looking for a job now.
Looking for a job.
Did you think about looking for a teaching job?
No.
You never wanted to play professor?
No, I knew the teacher. Actually, when I was on this postdoc, I was making the same amount of money as the prop who was heading up the whole thing and teaching also.
Mm-hmm.
It was a grand total of $7,500, and that's what he was getting, and I was getting $7,500 here. So I went looking for an industrial job.
Who did you interview?
Well, I interviewed DuPont, R.J. Reynolds, and GE. I picked R.J. Reynolds because I thought they had a hell of a product, out of the product, and they'd have to pay an awful lot to get people to work for them. But found out they didn't. So I had no interest.
Were you interested in Reynolds because
no.
Biochemical?
No, there are some tobacco biochemistry which is related, and I knew a little bit about it. And and they were advertising, and they just started a new laboratory in Salem, I guess. So I looked at it, but I was really more turned on with DuPont and Westinghouse. Actually, DuPont didn't, they had some interesting propositions, but they didn't interest me because of the management. And it appeared that everybody I talked to couldn't do anything unless I talked with their boss, and I talked with their boss, and they needed to get the vice president's approval to hire me. And I was a bit leery of such a long chain of command.
Was this the Central Station Research Place or one of the other?
This was, I was at Richmond, and they had a fiber place there,
right.
And at Deepwater, chemicals, and also a fabric and finishing place in
Philadelphia. Polymers.
But I really wasn't sold with that. Well, I met a guy named Al Zavist out at ACS meeting in Chicago. He told me all about the wonders of GE. I went to visit in Schenectady at GE at the what was the large steam turbine laboratory. I'm a dealer. And they had a great collection of people there. They were nice people to talk with. Zavis, I mean, Walt Marshall, and Andy Platinic, and George Browning, and their boss was a guy named Flynn, Ed Flynn. They're all damn nice people. So they made me an offer. It was, I had to take a $300 pay cut to go. I went there.
Is that right? Isn't that interesting?
But I don't want to get the idea that money is so important, but it was a fact that there was a $300 pay cut. They only offered $7,200 at the time. But the first thing that happened when I got there by pronouncement, I was an expert in insulation, which I didn't know anything about insulation. But I was an organic chemist. So they decided, I think they were going to make a polymer chemist out of me.
So this is, what, 1953. You had postdoced for the better part of a year?
For a full year.
Yeah.
Actually, I finished up my thesis in 52 and got a PhD in 53. At the time, I finished up the postdoc.
So you didn't interview at either the research lab or the plastics business?
No.
Just the
M&P. Actually, there was no plastics business.
Well, there was the Pittsfield phenolic place.
It really wasn't.
Yeah.
They had just about 51 pulled the pieces together and called it a chemical and metallurgical division. So I went to work in Turbine Lab, and it's connected to the M&P laboratory, and almost within a couple of weeks of the time I landed there, my boss, the boss's boss, Ed Flynn, told me that he had a policy of sending all of his new PhDs out to the research laboratory for a little orientation before they started in work in earnest. And everybody in the turbine there at MP Lab was very much interested in a new magnet wire, which was being sought at the research laboratory, which was